Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Paul D. Taylor. He has worked at the Natural History Museum London for 45 years. His research focuses on fossil and living bryozoans, as well as an evolution, paleoecology, and fossil folklore. But we're talking about his new book, Fossils, An Essential Guide. Paul, welcome to the show. It's such a pleasure to be talking to you about this book.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure for me to be talking about it too.
Yeah, when I was young, I actually wanted to be a paleontologist. I went to Clark University. They had one paleontology class, and that was the end of my career dreams. So I'm so glad I hooked up to your book. I've learned so much from the book too. And so I'm going to skip around a lot in the beginning because there's a really good introduction to paleontology, the first couple of chapters. But one of the things I never knew, and I never thought to ask, what is the origin of the word fossil?
Oh, yes. Well, fossil, for those who might not know, it basically means something that was dug up out of the ground. And in the early days, fossil was used for all manner of things that came from the ground. So it could be minerals that had been dug out, economic minerals in some cases, or it could be pottery, or all sorts of different things. And the word fossil didn't really become attached to what we now call fossils until, well, roughly 200 years ago, actually. They used to be called formed stones and all manner of different names, but not fossils in the old days.
Now, the process of fossilization is really complicated, and we don't have time to talk about all of that. But are the only minerals the best rocks that have fossils in them? Is it all just sedimentary rocks?
It's almost all sedimentary rocks. You can get some low-temperature igneous rocks, so some lava flows. By the time they get onto the surface, they're getting a little bit cooler, and occasionally tree trunks get caught up in amongst them and can be fossilized. They don't burn away entirely. There's something left of them. Alternatively, with metamorphic rocks, which are the rocks that are formed by the action of pressure and temperatures, if you don't have such intense temperatures or pressures, then fossils can survive if the metamorphic rock started out as a sedimentary rock containing fossils. But they tend to get distorted in those kinds of rocks, and eventually they get degraded and disappear entirely.
Now, this is going to be an odd question, but it's one I've always wanted to know. Does anybody have any idea how likely it is that any one organism becomes a fossil? It seems like it's extremely unlikely.
I don't think anybody's ever tried to put a figure on it. What we do know is if we look at today's biota and just make some kind of evaluation of what proportion of species are likely to be fossilized, then it's going to be a small minority. Things like earthworms and a lot of plants and many, many different forms will never make it into the fossil record. Then if you start to look at an individual organism, so an individual earthworm, or even an individual other species that might be fossilized, like a
trilobite,
clamshell, even for an individual, the chance of it being fossilized is slight. And then, of course, we've got the other filter is, if it gets itself into the rock record, if it becomes a fossil, maybe it's going to be eroded away before it can ever be discovered by a human being, or perhaps it just never appears on the surface, so we never see it, because we're only just seeing the thin skin of rocks on the Earth's surface. We're not seeing those that are way beneath our feet.
Now, and then you bring this up in the book, sometimes, rarely, entire communities of organisms are fossilized in a single slab.
I wouldn't say they're entire communities.
Oh, you're right. Okay, I accept that correction.
Yeah, entire communities.
That would be awful.
The sorts of organisms that would fossilize, like, for example, various kinds of shells, the trilobites you mentioned, corals, which have hard skeletons, they would fossilize. But within those communities, we know by looking at modern communities today, say coral reefs, a great deal of the animals living and plants living on coral reefs don't make it into the fossil record. Even things like the fishes, coral reefs today are absolutely abound with wonderful, colorful fishes. very few of those, though they do have teeth and they do have skeletons, they don't tend to preserve as fossils. They decay. Very few of them get fossilized together with the corals and the shells, which might survive. So we do have a very degraded picture of what was really there, and we have to make various, as a paleontologist, a person who studies fossils, we have to be aware of these caveats about what might be preserved and make various inferences about what might have been there but we don't see.
Now some fossils are common enough that they can be used as indications of the time period or the place, right? So that if you find one of these really common fossils, that can help you date and figure out the context for the other fossils.
Yeah, I would say that, I would say the majority of fossils give you some indication of the rough age of the rocks that they've come out of. But there are other fossils where if the species concerned had a very short range in time, then it can be very precisely determined the age of the rock. So particularly in Britain we use, and actually elsewhere in the world, we use ammonites a lot. So these are these wonderful curly cephalopod moths, and they have, each species had a geological range which might have been 1 million or 2 million years. So if you find that, you can then pinpoint the age of the rocks within that time period. So they're immensely useful. And the things that we use as geologists and paleontologists that are most useful as fossils for indicating ages, they have to be widely distributed. So you get a lot of species which are restricted to a certain area and they're not so good. But if you have transoceanic species, for instance, then they're going to be far, far better as guide fossils for the age of the rocks.
Now, almost, I would imagine, fossils that help you figure out that are index fossils are all invertebrates, right?
Yes, pretty much so. That's the ideal. So when you go, most of the fossil invertebrates that we deal with tend to be animals that lived in the sea, so they're marine. But when you go into sequences where the rocks are all deposited on the land surface, continental, and you don't get so many invertebrates. So people working on those rocks have often got to use plants or the spores from plants.
Oh, yeah.
Or alternatively, in some cases, they actually use vertebrate fossils. So there are zones that are put up according to vertebrate fossils. So it's not entirely a game for invertebrates. It can involve plants and vertebrates.
Now, I'm going to change up completely. I want to talk about mass extinction periods.
Oh,
And you do a great job of that at the in the beginning chapters of this book. I think a lot of people are familiar with the end of the Cretaceous.
Yeah.
But there are several other mass extinctions that came before that that I bet the general public don't know about, including one that really just about wiped out everything.
Yes. Yes. The really big, basically, there have been five major mass extinctions in the last 550 million years, so during the Phanerozoic era. And the largest of them all was not the one that wiped out the dinosaurs and the ammonites, but was one that took place about 250 million years ago at the end of the Permian period. And life did get pretty close to being entirely extinguished at that point in time.
Isn't it estimated like 90% of life got wiped out?
Yeah, that's what some people say. It's difficult to be sure, but it's certainly in terms, if you look at the extinction rate at that time, it's the highest of all those major five extinctions. And it was a very calamitous affair. And whereas we can be pretty sure that the extinction that wiped out the dinosaurs and the ammonites was at least in part and possibly largely due to the famous asteroid impact in Yucatan. The other one, the bigger one, 250 million years ago at the end of the Permian, we really don't have such a clear idea of what it might have been. The current theory is it was likely to have been a very large-scale volcanic activities.
But there's no proof that there was an impact crater or anything like that. Like they know for the end of the Cretaceous, they actually know where the asteroid hit.
Right, Yeah, there's no impact crater, nor is, to my knowledge, in the rocks, what is known as an iridium anomaly. The first clue that the end of Cretaceous extinction was due to an impact was when people started to find an enrichment in an element called iridium in some rocks at the very boundary. And iridium is concentrated very much in meteorites. So that gave the idea that, well, maybe there was some kind of collision of a bolide, as the more general term is said, with the Earth. And then later on, they found the Yucatan impact crater. But we don't have there are impact craters right through the geological column. I'm not aware that there's a particularly big one associated with the end Permian extinction. And I'm also not aware that there's an iridium anomaly. You could ask me again in about a year's time. The follow-up book to this fossils one, the museum have commissioned me to write a book about extinctions.
Oh.
I'm just gradually going through the main mass extinctions and trying to look at the most recent evidence and work out some kind of story for each of them. And it's proving very complicated so far. The older extinctions are not quite as clear-cut as the end Cretaceous one. They're rather messy. And in some cases, there are several pulses of extinction.
So is there a sense that possibly several things happen at the same time, simultaneously?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, you know, the reason I ask about that, too, is, you know, like I mentioned, I'm sure most people are familiar with the big impact crater at the end of the Cretaceous. But it also makes you realize the Earth is a lot more dynamic and crazy than most people realize. That stuff can happen physically to the Earth other than an impact that could cause huge amounts of destruction.
Absolutely. And I think if you take a kind of wide time span, then almost anything you could think of will have happened to the Earth at some point.
Well, there was a time that I think somebody referred to it as snowball Earth, where everything sort of froze up for a while.
Yes, that was in the late Precambrian.
Yeah.
And that's an idea which, when it was first mooted, was sort of fairly wacky. But there's now a lot of evidence that really did happen. And some people think it might have put a brake on the early evolution of complex life. I mean, life has been around a long time before Snowball Earth, but it might have actually stopped, put a brake on development for a while. So that's another fascinating thing that's happened in the Earth. We actually kind of we've sort of gone around in circles a bit with these major events that don't happen very often, these infrequent events. There was a time, there's a very famous British geologist called Charles Lyell, who really is known as kind of a uniformitarianist. So he would actually look at processes that we can now observe on life today and then infer that all the rocks we see are a result of those processes happening in the geological past. But people are thinking, well, maybe there were things that we don't really see happening today, so we're not around at the right time for something like a big asteroid to hit the Earth, that actually were also major drivers of what was going on, the kinds of rocks that were formed in the evolution of life.
It makes you realize that human civilization is in like this, actually on a geological level, a really narrow little window where nothing really big has happened.
I think you could say that, but then you could also say things big are happening and we are destroying our own environment.
Oh, that's a different thing. You're absolutely right. We're creating our own catastrophe.
Exactly,
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Paul D. Taylor. He's worked at the Natural History Museum in London for 45 years. His research focuses on fossil and living bryozoans, as well as on evolution, paleoecology, and fossil folklore, which is why there's so many stories in this book that are fascinating to read. His new book, and it's really a great introduction to paleontology, Fossils, an Essential Guide. Now, the basic question is, what are the oldest definite fossils that we know of? It goes back to the Precambrian, right?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of controversy. When you go back that far, then not only are there fewer rocks, but the rocks that you do tend to find tend to be rather metamorphosed. And the fossils, or supposed fossils in them, are rather basic in structure. And there's arguments about, are these really fossils, or are they just inorganic things?
Well, you're talking about microbial fossils.
Yeah, these are microbial. They're just a few microns, a thousandth of a millimeter in size.
Wow.
They're really, really tiny things. Yeah. And I think, generally speaking, people are saying that, well, probably there's reasonable evidence from those and also some geochemistry, isotopes and so on, in the rocks that probably life was around at least 3,500 million years ago. So within a billion years of the formation of the Earth, there was life on the Earth. And it was possibly even less than that.
Let's talk about stromatolites.
Oh, yeah.
I love those fossils. They're really fascinating. Yeah. What are they?
Well, they're layered structures that are produced by communities of microbes, really. In some cases, they're microbes called cyanobacteria. But in modern stromatolites, you can get a whole lot of other organisms as well. So there are stromatolites forming in various parts of the world at the moment. The most famous ones are in Shark's Bay in Western Australia.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very shallow lagoons. And essentially what's happening is these microbial organisms are trapping sediments and in some cases also secreting calcium carbonate coating around themselves. And they're doing this in layers, basically. And if you cut open a stromatolite, you have different organisms, different microbes at different levels in the stromatolite. And they build up from the out of the sea and in some cases actually breach the surface as well when the tide is low. But they're fascinating structures. And we have these are the first large fossils, if you like, or fossil communities.
Yeah.
And we have these going back billions of years in the fossil record, and geological record.
Now, I want to talk about several groups of creatures that become fossils, just because I like talking about them. They're all going to be invertebrates. Trilobites. Okay. We have to talk about trilobites. As you call them in the book, they're the movie star fossil. Trilobites are just amazing. They're wonderful to look at. There's all these different forms. Now, the first thing the audience needs to realize is they are arthropods.
Yes. Yes, they're arthropods. They have jointed skeletons like all modern arthropods do. So they have jointed limbs and flexuous skeletons made up of different segments. Another thing about them, which is kind of almost, I'm not sure whether it's quite uniquely arthropod, but almost so, is that they had compound eyes. They had eyes like a fly with lots of separate lenses.
Well, they had some of them had really good eyesight.
Yeah, I think there's been quite a lot of work done on the visual acuity of trilobites over the years, and it seems as though they had very good eyesight. They have several different kinds of eyes with different sorts of lenses, and the optics of them do differ according to different groups. About them is that the lenses in the eyes of trilobites are made of calcium carbonate, so chalk, basically.
Wow.
And that fossilizes really well. If they'd been constructed in the same way as the lenses of the compound eye of a modern fly, which is not mineralized at all, they wouldn't fossilize. It's only because they were made of calcium carbonate, which fossilizes extremely well.
Now, they're very abundant. How many species do we know of that we have found as fossils?
I can't tell you off the top of my head, but I would think it's in the many, many thousands.
Wow.
And probably still going up because they were enormously diverse during the Paleozoic. So from about 550 to 250 million years ago, they were really occupying a lot of ecological niches in the sea. Only in the sea. There are no ones that got onto land, and we don't know of them in fresh water either. But in the sea, some of them were sitting on the seabed. Others were burrowing shallowly into the sea. Others were swimming around above the seabed. And some were really oceanic, and part of the plankton.
Now, what did they predate on?
I'm not sure that we know a great deal about what they ate. Probably mostly soft-bodied organisms that don't fossilize. So
yeah,
we don't. Yeah. You know, it's not. Sometimes when we can sometimes work out what particular extinct groups of organisms ate. If they ate things that had a hard skeleton, then bits of those skeletons are often present there in the poo, the coprolites.
Yeah.
But there's not, or the gut contents, if you can see the gut contents inside. But I'm not sure with trilobites whether we know what they ate, but I would imagine some of them were probably algal grazers, other ones probably sifted very small organisms from the sediment, processing it through their guts in much the way, same way as an earthworm processes the soil and eats things. And then the ones that were swimming were probably going for plankton, either zooplankton, the animal plankton, or phytoplankton, the plant plankton.
Now, I've seen fossils that have them sort of coiled up like you see a pill bug.
Yeah.
Did they naturally are able to roll up like that as a defense mechanism?
Yeah, quite a lot of trilobites were able to do that, and we often find them preserved in that posture where they're completely rolled up, like an armadillo would do as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it is. It's exactly that, the defense mechanism. Quite what they were defend themselves against, we don't know, maybe fishes or maybe swimming, larger swimming arthropods at the time, maybe other trilobites in some instances. But that was a defense mechanism that the trilobites employed. And their skeletons are sort of very closely engineered so that they would form a really tight ball in many instances.
Some of the later species developed hugely wild spines all over their body.
Yes. That, again, is interpreted as being for defense, which I'm sure is correct. So it would make it harder for a lot of kinds of predators to bite into them. But there's another possibility with some of these. We know that at the present day there are bivalve mollusks in the sea, for example, that have spines. And actually those spines in some cases are there to provide a habitat for other organisms like sponges and seaweeds to grow on and therefore camouflage the animal, the bivalve itself. And it's possible that some trilobites were playing that same trick. So they were just, and we don't have those things that attach to them preserved as fossils, but maybe there were animals and plants attached to them, providing camouflage essentially. So it no longer looked like a trilobite. It looked like a sponge sitting on the seabed or a bunch of seaweeds and things. So there are alternative explanations, and in many cases it's quite hard as a paleontologist to be very decisive about which is correct. It's very hard to test these theories in many cases.
Now, one of the great things about your fossils, An Essential Guide,
yeah,
you bring in a lot of human folklore and ideas.
Yeah. That,
now, yes, we were talking about trilobites. What was the Dudley locust?
Okay, well, the Dudley locust is a trilobite that's called Calimony blumenbarki, to give it its full name, which was and still is very common in a place called Dudley, which is in the Midlands of England, where there are some rocks of Silurian age called the Wenlock Limestone exposed. And the quarrymen, because the Wenlock limestone was quarried for cement and as building stone, and they found these in great numbers and would sell them off. Or some well-known scientist or collector would go to them in advance and say, can you collect as many of these as possible in your spare time when you're not hacking away at the rock, and we'll buy them from you. And they, because of their general arthropod appearance, they just got the name of either Dudley locust or Dudley bug. both of those names have been used for them. And they were greatly valued, particularly in Victorian times.
Well, they were used in jewelry. Yep.
Yeah.
You have a beautiful example of a photo of one in the book.
Exactly. It's mounted in a golden brooch. And the idea was that people, I think maybe in the mid part of the 19th century, and I get that's where the date that brooch comes from. In those days, I think people were very aware of advances in natural sciences, particularly with Darwin's Origin of Species. And there was a great interest in the natural world, and people really wanted to have these trilobites, specimens of them, either just to put as ornaments around their house.
Well, they look cool. I mean, you got trilobites always look cool.
They're really pretty.
Yeah.
Really, really.
Yeah.
If you get the complete one. Now, I should say the great majority of trilobites that are collected are broken because the segments disarticulate. And sometimes you just get the head or the tail or just isolated segments of the thorax, which is the bit between the head and the tail. So you don't always get complete ones. But when you do get complete ones,
oh, God.
Amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. There are people, and you would address a lot of things to collectors in this book too.
Yeah,
and that sets it about completely aside from other paleontology guys I've seen, and so you mentioned things like that, and trilobites are infinitely collectible. I mean, they're wonderful. They're wonderful species. I'm just surprised nothing survived from trilobites. It's just so sad.
Oh. You mean that they became extinct?
Totally.
Entirely.
Yeah, one of the most common animals.
Well, the last trilobites became extinct at the time of that large extinction, which we were talking about earlier.
The end of the Permian, yeah.
So 250 million years ago. So their history was really terminated at that point. However, I would say they had been in decline for quite a while. Before then, but none of them got past that point. Nobody has ever found a younger trilobite than Permian in age.
Is there any sense about why they were declining to begin with?
Well, they were actually hit by some of the earlier mass extinctions.
Oh, okay.
Mass extinctions.
Well, you know what? We're going to have to end there. I just realized we're going to run out of time.
Yeah.
My guest tonight has been Paul D. Taylor. He's worked at the Natural History Museum London for 45 years. His research focuses on fossil and living bryozoans, as well as on evolution, paleoecology, and fossil behavior. And his new book is a great introduction to fossils. Fossils, an essential guide, and it's also beautifully illustrated with color photography. Paul, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.